Well, the biggest change that's already happened, it happened in 2011, was the appointment of Carolyn Lerner to be the special counsel. You know, the office had been troubled in the past. It had been a number of years, about a year and a half or so, with an acting special counsel. And there seems to be a breath of fresh air. The employees are energized at work in the special counsel's office, and I expect to see greater strides ahead in whistleblower protection. But even more important, there seems to be bipartisan agreement in Congress that whistleblower protection legislation needs to be passed. It needs to be improved. And there's some small differences between a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate that are being worked out. I'm optimistic that they will be worked out. I believe that these reforms are absolutely necessary. And once they happen, I think you'll see much greater whistleblower protection. And this is something that for about a dozen years now, the government hasn't been doing very well, and a lot of federal managers have had a little bit of a holiday from having to worry about the oversight of the Office of Special Counsel or really seriously having to deal with complaints of whistleblower reprisal. I think that's going to change, and I think it'll change. I hope it changes this year if Congress can pass this law.
And one of the provisions, I think, under debate is whether to bring in whistleblowers from contractors that would get similar protections. Is that part of
all
this?
Well, that's not part of the federal employee whistleblower law, but there are provisions to actually protect contractors and provide them with greater protection and allow them some recourse. There really isn't much protection for contractors now at all.
Bill, you said the differences between the House and the Senate versions are pretty minor. What are the areas they agree on and the areas that are likely to get enacted?
What they agree, because of some judicial precedent under the existing whistleblower protection laws, right now, if you're just doing your job, you're not protected. For example, if you're an inspector general auditor and you go out and you do an audit and you uncover some kind of wrongdoing and you report it, but your reporting is unpleasant and not well received and your boss wants you to sweep it under the carpet, and then you are viewed as unpopular and unwelcome, you're not protected. If you tell your boss that you think your boss is breaking the law, and your boss then views you as a threat and retaliates against you, you're not protected. So you're not protected if you're just doing your job. You're not protected if you make the disclosure only to the wrongdoer. Those are the major changes that both the House and the Senate agree should be made to expand what it means to be a whistleblower to include those two categories. Another major change that both houses agree, both the Senate and the House agree, is to allow that, you know, if you're a manager or an executive and you're accused of whistleblower reprisal and you fight it and you get a lawyer and you win, right now the attorney's fees are paid by the special counsel's office, which is a very small agency with about 110 employees with a very small budget. The law would change it so that the attorney's fees are still paid if you prevail. If you're a manager and you're accused and you're found to be innocent, your attorney's fees are still paid, but they're paid by your employing agency. And those are two very major changes and will actually go a long way to protecting whistleblowers. Where they disagree is on the issue of jury trials. The Senate version would allow very limited jury trials in federal court for whistleblowers, very limited circumstances. The House bill does not.
We're talking with Bill Bransford, a partner at Shaw, Bransford & Roth, as part of this week's Legal Loop Summit. Want to go back to the Office of Special Counsel paying attorney's fees and that loser pays system you mentioned a while ago. Is there evidence that that was really hindering their operations? You said they have a very small budget. Was it keeping them from doing what they needed to do?
Oh, I don't know that there's evidence that it's keeping them from doing it, but it just makes common sense that if they're making a decision, I mean, the special counsel's office acts like a prosecutor. And if they're making a decision to bring charges, disciplinary action charges against somebody who they think has violated the law by retaliating against a whistleblower, and they're looking at the strengths and weaknesses of their case, and if they feel like they have weaknesses and say, well, if we lose on this point, we're going to have to pay a very large amount of money in attorney's fees because this is going to be a long, drawn-out trial.
Oh, chilling effect, I see.
It has to play a role in that decision to prosecute or not. Now, some people might say, well, the special counsel can still bring a corrective action. They can still file an action to get relief for the employee who's been retaliated against. If somebody's been fired, let's say, in their probationary period because they've made a significant disclosure, they can still get that employee's job back, but they can't go after. Well, they can go after the wrongdoer, but if it's a little bit riskier, and so it has to play a role. But is there evidence? I don't think you're going to see anybody in the special counsel's office coming forward and sharing with you their deliberative process. That's something that they keep in house.
And let's switch gears for a minute, because we do have an election that's gearing up, and it seems to be getting acrimonious earlier even than usual. So it might be good to briefly review the Hatch Act, especially for those that might be new to the federal government.
Sure, and that's something else that's done by the special counsel's office. They do a tremendous job of Hatch Act enforcement, but also Hatch Act education. One of the things that federal employees should be aware of is if they have any question about what they can or cannot do at work, vis-a-vis political activity, they can call the Hatch Act office at the special counsel. Just go to osc.gov, find the phone number or find the whatever, however they say to contact them. I think you can send them an email. They will get back to you quickly with a binding opinion. As long as you've told them all the facts of what you want to do, they will tell you whether it's permitted or not. And for example, you shouldn't come into the office wearing a T-shirt supporting a particular presidential candidate. One of the more arcane rules is you're allowed to have a bumper sticker on your car if you drive it to work, but if you use that car in the course of the business of the day, you have to cover the bumper sticker. And of course, many, many federal employees get themselves in trouble by forwarding emails concerning political activity. It's not allowed. And social media presents its own unique challenges, and something that I saw a little bit of in 2008, and I hope I don't see it repeated in 2012, were very, very excited supervisors who would bring politics into the office, creating an environment or a sense that subordinates were somehow being pressured to support the same candidate. Those are some of the common pitfalls, but you are allowed to participate in political activity off duty. You are allowed to support candidates. There is a distinction between what I would call the worker federal employees versus the executives. There are more limitations on executives on what kind of political activity they can engage in than there are on their GS 12s or 13s, particularly those who are in unions have more more ability to engage in political activity. But it is something to be careful of, and again, the special counsel's office does a great job of outreach and education.